Welcome back to the Greater Green of Georgia podcast, where we dive into the environmental challenges and solutions shaping our future. Today, we are speaking with Georgia resident John Duke, also author, covering environmental issues, his experiences advocating for his community and others, and his vision for a better Georgia. Welcome to our podcast, Mr. Duke.
Thank you so much. It's an honor to be here. It's amazing. I appreciate it.
Awesome. Thank you for coming. We're also joined by our political director today, Ms. Connie DeSico. She's going to be sitting in and asking questions as well. So we're going to have a little three-person conversation here. It's going to be super fun. So usually I open up all podcasts with a fun question of sorts. So what is your favorite restaurant of all time? It doesn't have to be open now. It could have closed down. And what was your order? What did you get? What is it?
Well, it has to be the Brake Pad in my community. I walk to it many days for lunch. It's just down the street, and they just have great food at an affordable price and great beers.
The Brake Pad.
Okay, yeah, so the Brake Pad on historic College Park.
Okay, awesome. College Park. Uh-huh. And what's your food order?
Usually it's either the Cali BLT with avocado or... or the hummus wrap.
Oh, hummus. We love a good hummus. Chickpeas, yeah. Mm-hmm.
And their French fries are great. And they have, or if you're looking healthy, they have a great salad, you know, locally grown mixed greens. It's just a great place to hang out.
No, I want the fries.
So the hummus wasn't the healthy option. You're like, he said, if you want something healthy,
yeah.
I feel like the BLT, the hummus is pretty... Lettuce.
You're right.
I feel like that was
if you want to be real healthy, you know, you can get the salad with the hummus, see? Then you're just knocking it out of the ballpark.
Right. Okay, so tell us about your background as a floodplain analyst. How did you get started in the work? Was this the career path that you planned for yourself when you attended college? Where are you from? All the things.
Yeah. I don't want to get too deep into my career because I do want to focus on the clean energy transition here. But it's been an amazing long journey. I talk about it in my book. But I grew up in the suburbs of Birmingham, Alabama, and I graduated from Auburn University in what I call a applied biology degree. But I graduated from veterinary school there. And my first job out of school was in a rural town in Tennessee doing a lot of farm work. And I didn't stay there long, and immediately I went into the public health arena, which is why I went through the program anyway. And I was a contractor for the United States Department of Agriculture, and we were eradicating brucellosis, which is, you know, disease that had affected cattle for decades. And we were at the tail end of actually wiping it out. It was just an incredible thing to do. You felt like you were part of this big operation, probably as close as to what the World War II generation felt to me. Like, I'm part of this big, big operation to eradicate this disease. And they paid me $1.50 to go around the stockyards and blood test cattle. They pay me $1.50 per cow, per blood test.
So how many cows was it, per se?
Well, one day you might do 100 one day, or you might do 1,000. It's just a matter of what.
Payday.
Yeah, but
good payday.
It was, but you know, there wasn't a stockyard to do every day. It was just, I did, you know, two or three a week at the height of it. But it was my own full-time job, basically, and just loved it, man. And then they sent me to England during the foot and mouth epidemic, which occurred right during the time of 9/11. And I was actually in Newcastle, England on 9/11.
Wow.
And I was, when 9/11 happened, they canceled the program, and I was on one of the first planes back across the Atlantic after planes started flying again. So all of that ran out. The federal funding went away. I had two choices. I either I'd either could go into private practice, which I did not. It just didn't interest me. I had delved in it some. I needed to do something bigger than just individual people's problems or whatever. And so I walked away from the career and I drove to Ely, Minnesota, which is where I had gone to every summer in college working as a canoe guide. And I
such a colorful array, veterinary, canoe, and, like, well, I, all these little nuggets. I love it. Keep going.
I attended this community college there for 2 years. I lived in Ely, Minnesota is further north by latitude than Montreal, Quebec. That's how high it is. It's 10 miles from the Canadian border. It's the end of the road. They have a radio station there called End of the Road Radio. It literally is.
I love that, actually.
And there was a junior college there, that Vermilion Community College, and I went there for 2 years and took every hydrology and ecology class I could. I wanted to understand the carbon cycle. I wanted to get into the environmental arena. And I struggled with, when I was in vet school, of dropping out, because I didn't know how to make a living in the environmental field. Yeah. And this junior college was some of the best education, I'm not kidding you, that I have ever gotten. It was an incredible 2-year experience.
Wow. What college was it?
Vermilion Community College.
Shout out to you guys.
In Ely, Minnesota. And when I finished that, I came back home to Atlanta, and because I had been living here, I've lived here for almost 30 years now, in historic College Park. But I had kept my home here when I was there, and I came back and tried to feel my way, and through a circuitous route, working for some engineering firms and writing ecology reports for projects. I found my way to my own business doing floodplain modeling for 20 engineering firms in 26 different states now so far.
Wow.
So, and it's all I do. I found the niche just through experience and through a business coach, and here I am. And it's just, I love what I do. It's the fun. I feel like I build puzzles every day. I've financially been successful with it. It's just been an amazing journey.
So for the people that don't know, what is floodplain? What is that?
Yeah, so if you've ever seen a FEMA floodplain map, I may have created it.
Okay.
Most of them were made a long time ago, but I may have altered it or, updated it.
Okay, so
that's the simplest way to put it. I do more than just FEMA floodplain maps, but that's something that people can understand.
Okay, awesome.
Yeah.
So the floodplain is telling you where the flood is?
Yeah, where you have risk of flooding, and where you should, where your local governments are managing that area. As far as development goes,
right,
and that's a whole another discussion of whether they,
whether
it's being managed properly or whatever. But again, I think we're here for the energy transition. But
it all works. Yeah, it all comes together. So, what inspired you to leave the suburbs and embark on the journey to document climate crisis firsthand?
Well, the Leaving the Suburbs, which is the title of my book, is really it's a tongue-in-cheek title, okay? I probably still live in the suburbs, basically in College Park, but although there's an expert in the book, I don't know, maybe I could read it or something Okay, and it's, I marked it here, just to highlight kind of, I guess, American culture and how we think about things. So Yeah, I'll just do some reading. Yeah. How about that? 26 years after crossing. So the book is basically about a 3,300-mile bicycle ride I did solo across the entire continent.
Cyclist.
Across the entire continent one summer when I was in college at Auburn. And I rode from the West Coast all the way through, went through Ely, and then across the Upper Peninsula, Michigan, and came back to Alabama, where my parents, of course, lived. And, you know, and the book sort of documents the climate crisis along the way. But at the end of the book here, I write, 26 years after crossing the Alabama line on my bicycle, I was firmly rooted in my suburban community of College Park, Georgia. But are we really suburban? By the standards of population density, we certainly are. However, being next to the busiest airport in the world, there is a lot of land below the flight path that has no residents, and that fact skews the true density. By the standard of distance from the center of the urban core, 7 miles of the ninth largest metro area in the United States, we could be suburban. When the town was incorporated in 1891, it certainly was. On the other hand, the urban core is only 5 metro stops away, and the community has no less than 6 metropolitan transit buses zigzagging through the community. If you were to sit through a funeral service at the Episcopal Church on Main Street, which I have, you might notice a slight vibration in your seat every 4.5 minutes as the metro train rumbled by at 60 miles an hour. You'd think, I must be in the city. But if I were to drop you inside Ward 4, where there are brick ranches on half-acre lots, you would say, no, this is the suburbs. If I drop you off in a residential in the residential areas around the old depot where the early 20th century bungalows sit on 50-foot wide lots near 4-story upscale apartments, you would say, no, this is urbane. If you saw the Family Dollar store sitting on top of an expansive parking lot along Virginia Avenue, you might be inclined to lean towards suburbia. After you walked from that parking lot and then down the sidewalk for 6 blocks to a cafe on Main Street, you'd say, nope, it's the city. Regardless, I had lived there long enough to gain enough institutional knowledge of the place that I could quote figures out of the $112 million annual city budget. I knew the balance on every one of the 13 revenue bonds our city owed. I knew the city manager on a first-name basis and most of the city's department heads. Also knew the homeless people by name who lived along the railroad line.
Wow.
So that's the premise of the title there. It's it's sort of a dig at our development patterns, which have hugely created to the climate crisis as well.
Yeah.
And you know what we're doing, some of us in the trenches fighting or change, like Strong Towns, Parking Reform Network, you know, we understand that and trying to actually change American culture is what we're really doing.
I think that discord in what you're describing is prevalent in a lot of suburban counties in Metro Atlanta, more pronounced in the southern parts of Metro.
Yeah, it is.
Yeah, right. I mean, like Atlanta has not done a good job in
And curtailing the sprawl.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
A huge climate solution is to densify. There's so much opportunity just in College Park, which is on the MARTA line, to thicken it up. You know, there's so much infill opportunity just right there.
Right.
You know, the density of College Park, ironically, is about the same as the density in Ely, Minnesota, and there's only 3,000 people live there,
right.
And it's in a very rural area of the
right.
country.
There's smart people here, there's resources here, but we're not maximizing the potential. It's potential, it's opportunities, and using it to the most, you know, and
right.
it's that long-term planning, which Georgia, Atlanta has not been good at. You see it with how MARTA is the best example that you can give.
Yep.
Yeah.
In terms of that, I think. But you see it throughout that entire area and that sprawl and spread.
Yeah, sprawl is also financially unsustainable.
Right.
Financially, it's not forget climate, forget, you know, the bond debt of municipalities across the country would scare you to death, you know.
And for the people that aren't familiar, what is sprawl? We say that word a lot. What is sprawl?
Sprawl is just, you know, it's jumping over opportunity to densify an area where you can share resources and you know, it's how our communities used to be built before World War II. You know, before World War II, sprawl didn't exist. You know, cities expanded chaotically and just, you know, that there might be some areas that look run down and then they would eventually improve and then things would thicken up and then slowly, and that's just how it was, a very organic process.
Right.
There was, you know, not a lot of top-down direction. And
right. And
it was by necessity because people, you know, walked and they...
So climate change is a growing concern for Georgia residents, really all of America. What specific policies have you advocated for to address environmental protection and climate resilience in your community and then just greater Georgia in general?
Yeah. Well, so in my community... I put in a lot of blood, sweat, and tears. So just a lot of different things, a lot of different avenues, different approaches. One example is I had a good friend of mine who bought a bus shelter, used bus shelter from the Chattanooga Transit Authority, and he paid $500 for it. And
wow.
he went and picked it up and brought it to College Park. And there was a bus stop pad that had no shelter where people were standing out in the rain and the sun. And I took a concrete drill and put bolts in the ground and that pad. And one Sunday morning, we bolted that thing down.
Wow.
So we've done things like, you know, what I called rogue infrastructure improvements.
Yeah.
or random acts of infrastructure, random acts of kindness, random acts of infrastructure. Because, you know, I've bugged city officials enough to say, well, why don't you do something? Why don't you? Well, it's MARTA's problem. No, it's your problem. It's our land. Come on, you know. Anyway, things like that, just trying to create, like my community is walkable, but the thing is, it doesn't have the aesthetic sometimes. Mm. It doesn't look right, you know, and you may not use the bus, but the bus shelter still makes the place look better. It's like putting a bow tie on a suit, you know. I mean, plus we don't want to see those people standing in the hot sun. Other things, you know, I gave a presentation. I had a councilwoman, Jamel McKenzie, who gave me the mic. Open mic night, I call it, at the city council workshop session. And I gave a 10-minute PowerPoint presentation on how College Park could actually become the first Georgia municipality to have 100% clean electricity.
Right.
You know, and it's like, well, we're a member of MEAG. So we're actually a MEAG affiliate, which is the Municipal Electric Authority of Georgia, which is basically Georgia Power's little brother. I mean, Georgia Power sets the lead and they're kind of following because MEAG owns 23% of the Plant Vogtle project, for example. You know, Georgia Power owns about half of it. 23% is owned by MEAG, and the other quarter is owned by other electric cooperatives. But so what I'm trying to bring to the table is to think outside the box. We're like, well, we can't do that. We're under MEAG. Well, yeah, you can, because you get to make choices.
Right.
In your, even as a member of MEAG, you as a member get to make choices of where you want your power supply to come from. So anyway, I gave a presentation. I made a YouTube video of it to you. I'll give it to you later. And it gives first oversight of where the world's moving and how fast China is actually moving toward renewable energy and just beating our pants off, you know? And then it gets, so it starts out with a big overhead, and then it gets into the specifics of College Park.
What do you see as the biggest barrier to achieving that goal in Georgia? And how can we, the people, help to accelerate that progress, that process?
Yeah, the biggest barrier is, you know, it's the monopoly utility business that's being regulated by a captured public service commission.
Yep.
And captured is not my word. This has been talked around in the podcast circles, like Energy Transition Show with Chris Nedler. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you watch that. The Volts podcast by, it's David Roberts. And others like Bill McKibben's Third Act. That's another group that he runs. Third Act is for meaning your third act of your life. They're older, you know.
Yeah.
That care about their grandchildren and stuff. But they've actually had sessions on this, the captured public service commissions, not just in Georgia, yeah, but in other places all across the country.
We want to thank you for coming on our podcast today. It has been an incredible, insightful conversation.
Great.
So at the end of every podcast, we always do like a 2-minute thing. If there's something you can talk about for 2 minutes, but we're going to say goodbye to the camera.
Okay.
And to everybody, guys, thank you so much for joining us. And thank you so much, Mr. John Duke, for being here today.
It's been my pleasure.
For this insightful conversation. Thank you.